start. So it's a pleasure to introduce to you this afternoon my friend Akupa. Akupa, I know Akupa quite well. We've spent a number of retreats together. We've led retreats together, and spent time in the Pyrenees in Catalonia together as well. And he's just he's a very clear and creative communicator, and it's a real delight to sort of hear the there's a great depth to the way that he reflects on things, which he shares very beautifully in the talks that he's done, and also in a book he's written, Saving the Earth, which Windhorse Publications have published and is at the Woodfield shop up there if you'd like a copy. And that's a slight rewrite of a book, Touching the Earth, which came out about 10 years ago.
2002.
Or so, yes, 8 years ago. And, well, there was a time around that time when I think Cooper was one of the main people writing about our relationship with the planet, with social justice, and was really, really important for me personally and a lot of other people to have that being communicated so well, with such sort of thought and authority. And Akupa has worked in around environmental issues and worked in local government and in political settings, and sort of knows his stuff. He really knows his stuff, and he really communicates about it brilliantly. And I appreciate his depth and calm and integrity, actually, in the way that he does that. So I'll hand over to Akupa. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Maitra Sara, for those very kind words. Can you hear me okay, Sara? Can you hear me at the back okay? Yeah, thumbs up. Good. Give me a feedback.
I can't hear you.
Okay, yeah. You can hear me now. I'm getting a bit of feedback. There you go. Okay, that's a bit better, I think. Yeah, a bit better. Good, okay. Okay, so the title that's on the programme for this talk is A Shambhala Warrior in Hell and Other Ordinary Places. The meaning of that will emerge in the talk. But basically, what I wanted to do was just respond to the theme, Butterfield's theme for this year, which is a force for good in the world. So really, what I'm going to give here is just my own sort of reflections on what it might be to be a force for good in the world, but drawing very much on my own experience over the last few years, really. So, first of all, a Shambhala warrior. I won't go into the whole background of that, but a Shambhala warrior, that phrase comes from an old Tibetan legend. That there will come a time when the earth will be in crisis, and that there will arise, sort of independently from a lot of different places, people who will, in a way, be a force for good in the world, and who will bring about change, not through force, not through the sword, but through wisdom and compassion. So, I think a Shambhala warrior is just somebody who aspires to do that, really. That's what that means in the title. In Hell and Other Ordinary Places, I've spoken about that title because one of the things I'd like to talk about in particular, Yasha Bodhi's suggestion when she asked me to do the talk, was, for the last 9 years or so, I've been working as a Buddhist prison chaplain. that's taken up quite a lot of my time and energy in the last 9 years. And that, in a way, it's quite, in some respects, it's quite a sort of hellish atmosphere to work in. So I'd like to say a little bit about that. Other ordinary places. Well, the original subtitle of this talk was One Man's Journey Through the Prisons, Bus Stops and Council Offices of Northern England. Okay. So those are the other ordinary places that I'll be touching on. So, interweaving with this, I think, basically, to sort of jump to the conclusion, I think what I'd like to sort of say is that is to express a sort of intuitive conviction that actually, to be a force for good in the world, we need to have confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So I'll be interweaving those sort of thoughts in what I'm saying. That in a way, to have some sort of confidence, to live from a confidence in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, is to exert, and maybe is the best, maybe even the only way, if you think of it very broadly, of exerting a force for good in the world. But I'll go through those. But maybe first of all I could just start off with confidence in the Buddha, and why that might be a force for good in the world. Well, first of all, what might that mean? What does it mean to have confidence in the Buddha? The way I'd like to sort of think about it here is to think of confidence or faith in the Buddha as a kind of intuitive conviction that life holds possibilities beyond or higher than our current understanding. And that there are qualities that we can attain as human beings that are intrinsically worthwhile, kind of meaningful, beautiful, you could say. And that these are embodied in the Buddha. These are Buddha qualities. And I think that in a way, just even just that, it sounds very sort of simple, just that sort of conviction that kindness, that clarity are sort of worthwhile, that they're intrinsically meaningful, I think is a very, very powerful thing that can actually transform people's lives. Also, can you imagine a world without that, where nobody, in a way, whether they call themselves Buddhist or not, but where nobody had a sense of kindness as being kind of worthwhile? Can you imagine what a sort of desolate world that would be? So, I think that's a very powerful belief. So, in a way, what I'd like to do is to talk a bit about how I've seen that work out in the prison work that I've been doing over the last period of time. So first I'll just say a few things about Buddhism in prisons, particularly in this country, in England and Wales. Because I think in a way there's something quite remarkable going on in prisons that perhaps not a lot of other people know about. It's almost a sort of mini Dharma revolution. So, according to the figures, Buddhism is the fastest growing religion amongst the prison population in England. Okay, a lot of people assume that that's Islam, but it isn't, it's Buddhism. And in fact, the prison population, this might take a bit of getting your head around, the prison population in England is one of the most kind of avowedly Buddhist of all the sort of communities you might choose to look at in the UK. Okay, your chances somebody worked it out, that your chances of being a Buddhist, if you're a prisoner, are about 10 times greater than the statistical probability of being a Buddhist as part of the general population. And more so if you're serving a very long sentence. So it's almost like the more serious a crime that you've committed, the more likely you are to be a Buddhist. Now, that does raise a question. That has basically come about not because Buddhists commit more crimes, but because Buddhism, that's almost entirely because of people coming to Buddhism once they're inside prison, okay? And that has largely come about through the work of an organisation called Angulimala, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, which is a kind of network of people who work in the prisons, in doing, well, as Buddhist prison chaplains. And that's largely come about through the sort of dedication and energy of Ajahn, Venerable Ajahn Kemadamo, who has worked throughout that time and has sort of built up this network of people. So I've been doing that for about 8 or 9 years. Maybe what I could do is just sort of talk about, I have to be very careful in a way. I can't sort of talk about individuals too much. I'll refer to some individuals, but obviously I can't give names and I can't give too many details. But just as a sort of illustration, in a way, of the effect that Buddhism has, and the effect, I think, that this, in a way, just this conviction that Buddha qualities, or the qualities we associate with the Buddha, are worthwhile, and the effect that that can have on a life. So, just to think of a few individuals that I've had a lot to do with over the last few years. One guy I know who came into prison, very, very sort of violent background. And the way he's put it, he was illiterate. He was brought up on a very deprived council estate, and a background of sort of physical abuse and so on. And the way he described it to me is that when he was a kid, he simply never learned empathy. That, you know, that's a part of our sort of development usually as kids. For some reason with him, it was sort of missed out. It just never happened. And somehow when he got into prison, I think through the influence of a friend of his, he started getting interested in meditation and Buddhism. And that sort of motivated him also to learn to read, to read better. And he started then to sort of read not only about Buddhism, but sort of read more widely. So he sort of educated himself in prison as well. And, from being a very angry, violent prisoner, he became someone in a way still no easy touch, but basically a very sort of positive force for those around him, a very sort of helpful to other prisoners and so on. He moved prisons. I don't know what the end of that story is. I hope he's sort of progressing by now. Another guy, similar sort of story, very sort of violent background, someone with just a lot of anger, again has learnt to meditate, and it's just a very sort of calm, again, just a very sort of calm character now, a sort of sense of direction in his life. He actually does quite a lot of embroidery now in the sky. it's sort of, yeah, he's sort of definitely sort of making progress. Another character who was an American citizen and was in the Vietnam War, and I don't know if you know what happens in the Vietnam War, but one of the things that would happen is that the American soldiers, the GIs, were drugged up to the eyeballs to go out on these kind of missions, which would last several days and nights. And of course, you know, this just did a lot of them in. A lot of them very, very sort of traumatized and sort of physically affected by these drugs that they were sort of strongly encouraged to take. And this character was one of these, and ended up just sort of committing random acts of violence. He was actually in prison for just randomly stabbing someone on the street. And when he got into prison, was again just very disruptive. Probably about 15 years ago, before I knew, came across Buddhism, started to learn to meditate, and really changed very, very quickly to being someone quite sort of self-possessed, someone with very sort of strong values. And he's someone that I sort of have a cup of tea with quite regularly now. And in a way, he's quite a sort of, it seems strange, but he's quite a kind of motherly figure on the wing to the other prisoners. Or the other prisoners kind of look to him, it might sound strange to say, as a sort of mother figure on the wing. Another story. A man who had killed someone under the influence of drugs, and experienced the most intense remorse, to the point that he just couldn't stand it, and he attempted, had some very good attempts at suicide several times, and it was kind of remarkable that he survived at all. There were very serious attempts. But again, something about the influence of Buddhism and meditation saw him through that, and with the help of other people, it has to be said, with the help of psychologists and so on, he sort of dealt with the remorse, the sort of depression that came with that. And within about a year of those suicide attempts, he was actually acting as what's called a listener in the prison system, which is someone who gives counselling to people who might be suicidal. So he was actually helping others who, you know, were struggling to deal with what he'd dealt with, and he was into to music, and again was sort of making progress. Just a couple of more stories. There was one guy who was an armed robber. He held up and robbed a lot of building societies. And anyway, he was the ultimate. There was one day I was in. I sort of go and talk about Buddhism, and I was kind of giving a hypothetical example. I was trying to sort of make a point about karma and the fact that, in a way, you don't get away with it. And I was sort of thinking, well, giving a hypothetical example of, say, a bank robber who gets away with a lot of money and has a yacht on the Mediterranean and is apparently happy. And I was talking about it, and this guy piped up and said, that was me. That was me. He said, and he actually, it was building societies, and he did have a yacht, or he was sort of living on a yacht in the Mediterranean. He's apparently had sort of got away with it. But he was also very conscious. He was sort of living with the fear of being caught, and he was living with the sort of remorse about the, he hadn't actually shot anyone, but the sort of fear that he'd caused was sort of really troubling him as well. And again, well, eventually the law did catch up with him, but he's very sort of devout Buddhist now, and again, someone who's very just sort of committed to getting out of prison and just leading a sort of peaceful, useful life. So another kind of turnaround. And finally, there was a guy who was actually a member of the mafia and ended up in a British prison, and became a very devout follower of Buddhism. I don't know what to say about him other than that he was just an incredibly positive character when I came across him. Again, very, very devout, but just incredibly sort of strong and positive under the influence of Buddhism. So, well, you know, here are basically some very, very troubled lives. And people who found amid those very troubled lives, it's not like a kind of professed conversion to some kind of faith, to some kind of belief in something outside their experience. That does go on in prison. I don't think that's what's going on with these guys, nor is it something that they do in order to please the prison authorities. It's not something, you know, to sort of please, to get good psychiatric reports or something. That doesn't tend to work. I really do think with these guys that it's something that something true and real that they've sort of touched in their own experience, and it's something about this sort of conviction that it's a good and worthwhile thing to live a life of kindness and clarity and compassion, and that has really, in a way, they're just a few stories. I've come across hundreds of guys of whom this could be said. So yes, faith in the Buddha, I think, is just a very powerful transformative force in the world. Just something about my own experience in that work as well, in working as a prison chaplain. I think, you know, it's taught me quite a lot. Part of it is just sort of being with suffering. You know, to use the word hell in relation to what these guys are going through and what they've put other people through is not too strong a word. And I think, you know, to begin with, perhaps there's always a sort of tendency to try and sort of sort things out for people. And one of the things I've definitely learned is just to sort of listen and just to sort of be with that suffering. And that's been, you know, that's definitely been something that's taken quite a lot of learning. In a way, what do you do when, you know, you have three conversations in one evening about murders that have gone on from the perpetrator's point of view? Also, there's been times when I've been conscious of of the particularities of a crime that's happened. You know, it's been in the papers, and I you know, you read about the crime and you just sort of think, these are evil, wicked sort of people. And then you actually sort of come across them, and they're not, you know, they're just kind of wrecked human beings, in a way. And for me, it's somehow being able to sort of hold their kind of humanity still, to respond to them as human beings, while also being aware of what they've done and being aware, it's almost like the victims are there as well, very sort of present in my mind. And in a way, trying to sort of hold both of those. Well, again, that's something that's sort of taken quite a lot of learning. I think there is a sort of tendency sometimes to sort of think of of people who've done really, really bad things, particularly with the tabloid press, is to sort of characterise them as these sort of evil people. And I don't like to sort of think of them in that way, because in a way, to call them evil is to sort of confer a specialness on them. And actually, there's nothing special about those people. They're just sort of car crashes of human lives. You know, they've caused terrible suffering to other people, and in a sort of moral and spiritual sense, terrible suffering to themselves. Anyway, I think, you know, this recent case of Raoul Moat, you know, some people are already kind of making him out as some kind of folk hero or something like that. And of course, well, you know, he's not. He's just a sort of desperate, sad human being, and that is my sort of sense of those people. They're not sort of... The idea of kind of romanticising them in some sort of way is just completely false. I think one of the main things I've sort of learned through this prison work, or sort of seen very clearly, is how right the Buddha was when he talks about the law of karma. I think, somewhere in the Dhammapada, the Buddha talks about, you know, no matter how far you go, what mountains you cross, and so you cannot escape the effects of karma. And I just think that's so sort of true. I've never in my time come across an example of someone who has sort of got away with it in that sense, that if you do something very sort of serious that's negative, that it sort of puts you in a corner, that either you kind of live a half life, shutting yourself off from your own humanity, not facing up to things, or you've got to sort of face the remorse, which is just incredibly difficult if you've done something very, very sort of heavy. The law of, whenever I talk about karma in the prisons, it's a really big issue. You know, I've always sort of got their attention, this idea that in a way, you know, if putting it very simply, that we are the result of our actions, and if we act positively, then the result is happiness. If we act destructively, negatively, then the result is suffering. The truth of that is perhaps nowhere more apparent than with those guys. So those are a few. Just a few reflections on my experiences of working amongst prisoners. As I said, hell is a very ordinary place from that point of view. In a way, it's the fact that it's so ordinary and so real that perhaps makes it so hellish. But, the subtitle that I gave also talks about the bus stops of Northern England. I spend quite a lot of time at bus stops. I use a lot of public transport. And I think, in a way, that's equally important in terms of being a force for good in the world. Is that the sort of state of mind that we have while at bus stops or on buses or on trains or whatever. I've often thought, actually, there's almost enough in terms of the kind of Buddhist practice of using public transport, there's almost enough to write a whole book on that. I think the reflection is basically that sometimes we can think that being a force for good in the world is all about the sort of those crucial moments, those sort of intense encounters like with those prisoners or whatever. But I was reflecting that actually 99% of my life is spent in completely trivial moments, like at bus stops. And it's what we're doing with our state of mind that actually exerts a force on the world. For example, you know, just to say in terms of working on patience, that's an obvious sort of thing that can happen at bus stops. You know, I've been standing here 15 minutes, the bus hasn't arrived, I've counted down from 100 and it still hasn't arrived. You know, we've all sort of been there. How do we sort of cultivate patience? Dealing with anxiety, sort of accepting that I'm going to be late for work or for an appointment. Just that sort of acceptance. There's also a kind of insight element to this, the practice of working with public transport as well. Whoever promised me that I would live in a world where buses would arrive on time, okay? Or if they did promise me that, whoever promised me a world in which those promises would be kept. I live in a country with imperfect transport, public transport. Get over it. You know, this is the sort of Vipassana insight kind of element to public transport. And also working with loving kindness, with metta bhavna, with the cultivation of kindness. I think one of my habits on public transport is to put up a kind of invisible barrier around myself and slightly resent anybody who gets in sort of my sort of private space. And working with that, you know, actually doing a kind of metta bhavana on the move, I find can be incredibly sort of transformative. So, why do those moments matter? You know, why am I talking about these moments in terms of being a force for good in the world? I think partly because if we don't work with our minds, our sort of heart and mind responses in those moments, then when it comes to the sort of more, what we might think of as the more crucial times, then we'll be lost, you know. In a way, those moments of preparation, those are the times when we're sort of steadily, little by little, bringing into the world those Buddha qualities of patience and insight and kindness. Those are the only places, in a way, where we can actually only, where we can work to bring those into being. I remember somebody talking about this idea of sort of doing the metta bhavana, the Buddhist meditation practice of cultivating loving kindness. I remember hearing that someone talk about the idea of doing this kind of not only on the meditation cushion, but on the move, as it were. And somebody, some young guy, remarking that that seemed a very sort of feminine, a very sort of women's approach to Buddhist practice, okay? And he said that in a rather disparaging way, I have to say. Okay. And, if that's the case, then that's fine by me, but to me, that is actually it's the essence of the Buddhist quality of virya or energy. It seems to me that approach to practice. If it's a feminine practice, then that's fine. But it's also the epitome, it seems to me, of a sort of energy and working with one's states of mind. So that was all under the heading of confidence in the Buddha, in Buddha qualities, and in a way just having confidence that is worthwhile, that it's worth, it's meaningful to bring those qualities into the world. Moving on to confidence in the Dharma, I'd like to say a bit about how this, in my experience, is also a force for good in the world. I remember before I was a Buddhist, many years ago, I think I sort of decided in my life that the only sort of meaningful thing was to sort of make the world a better place. I was sort of struggling for, in a way, what's the point of being alive? And the conclusion that I came to is just to try and make the world a better place. And I think that was a very positive intention. And my response was to get involved in a very sort of political way. As Maitrisara said, I got involved in the Labour Party, God help me, and so I got involved in sort of institutional local politics up in Newcastle. And I don't regret that, but for me that was the beginning of the journey. It wasn't the sort of whole of the journey. I think while it's a very good intention to have, I think there's also a danger that the idea of being a force for good in the world can itself also get in the way. In a way, my own history, I've sort of moved away from a very sort of political involvement, a very institutional involvement, following the party line, having definite opinions about things, having a lot of arguments and holding positions about this and that and all the rest of it. And then the more that I've practiced Buddhism over the years, it's more, well, I've sort of undergone a kind of shift in how I sort of see myself, if I am a force for good in the world, and in how I do that. And it's perhaps difficult to put my finger on what that shift is, but it's something about a shift away from, on the one hand, an emphasis on those very sort of institutional, formal ways, sort of engaging in formal structures, to something more about sort of changing relationships, something more about kind of building trust, building relationships of trust. A shift away from, you know, I think one of the sort of downfalls that we can get into in terms of sort of being politically active is not only wanting to change the world, but wanting to sort of have a stake on, to sort of claim a stake on, this is the change that I did, okay? Not only of I've been a force for good in the world, but look everyone, this is what I've done. Okay? In a way, somehow needing that in order to feel sort of vindicated and worthwhile and meaningful. So something about this shift is moving away from that to just being able to try to just sort of do things without needing that sort of sense of vindication, without sort of putting a stake on things, claiming a stake on things. I mean, certainly, you know, seeing outcomes of one's actions, that's important. It's important feedback sometimes, but it's something about just not needing that in a way, just being satisfied to do what you do, whatever that is, whether it's political action or whether it's doing massage, which is fine, whatever sort of field of activity you're in, just sort of taking confidence, that positive, kind, clear activity is sort of meaningful for its own sake, somehow. Also, perhaps something about this shift is moving away from an emphasis on kind of rational, quantifiable change. So, I think when the government talks about sort of change in the world, they often, there's this whole sort of culture, isn't there, around sort of targets and so on. Everybody, teachers, even Buddhist prison chaplains, you have to sort of fill in forms about what you've done, how you've used your time, and sort of tick boxes to show that it's been sort of good, purposeful activity. Whereas I think, again, something about this shift I'm talking about is more, there's been more of an emphasis on just a sort of intuitive confidence in qualitative change. More of an emphasis on states of mind, on happiness, rather than sort of materialistic kind of outcomes. And in terms of how it feels to be involved in change, I think there's something about making a shift from, well, actually that sort of goal-oriented way of changing the world. It can feel quite dry and empty if it isn't based on that sort of relationship of trust, if it's not based on hearts and minds change. Whereas I think that what we're moving towards is a kind of way of changing the world which is also completely sort of fulfilling. It's sort of naturally in tune with our own needs as human beings as well. Towards the end of my sort of time involved in sort of formal local politics in Newcastle, I think I was out canvassing for the Labour Party, and I always remember there was the man from Stanhope Street, who's quite, Stanhope Street's just a street in Newcastle, but there's this man from Stanhope Street who, he was the sort of man who was living in quite a deprived part of Newcastle, very, very deprived part of Newcastle. And he just expressed a lot of sort of despair, really, that a lot of money had been spent in the area and it wasn't really sort of changing things. And while the man from Stanhope Street, he was, in a way, he was quite despondent, he was quite negative, but nevertheless, he sort of touched on a truth for me that I sort of saw at that time, that a lot of what I was doing involved in trying to change the world in that way, to use a sort of hackneyed expression, it was a bit like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. It wasn't really bringing about sort of deep, meaningful change. It wasn't really sort of touching people's lives. It wasn't bringing about that kind of hearts and minds change that was really sort of what was needed. And that truth, in a way, was one of the things that sort of impelled me to look for a different way to bring about change in the world. And one of the things that has sort of drawn me towards a more sort of spiritual, more Buddhist path. So I do think, yeah, well, one of the things that really, if there's again one thing that underlines this shift on being a force for change in the world, to come back in a way to the metta bhavana, to this Buddhist ideal of kindness. It's a bit, for those of you who've done the metta bhavana practice, it can seem a bit of a wildly idealistic practice, that, you know, here we are, you get to the final stages, and what you're trying to do in the Metta Bhavana is sort of wish the whole world well. Okay, you're wishing happiness to every being in the world. Now what an absolutely crazy, impossible wish, you know, in a way. It flies in the face of any sort of realism. It flies in the face of all the odds. It flies in the face of the whole sort of weight of cynicism in the world. And yet we do it, you know, and yet that is what we're trying to do. And well, yes, maybe it is against all the odds. But I think there's just something about what we're doing in the Metta Bhavana practice is we're sort of keeping something alive in the face of all the sort of suffering in the world. We're keeping alive at least a sort of wish that all shall be well and free from suffering. And I just have a sort of conviction. Again, this is sort of, I can't prove this. I can't sort of give figures. I can't give a sort of rational proof of this. But I just have a conviction that having that wish against all those odds and sort of holding to it and allowing that to inform one's life is a force for good in the world. Anyway, it also brings me to the final point, which I'll talk about quite briefly, and that is faith in the Sangha. Because I think, again, part of this sort of shift that we need to make away from a sort of conventional approach to changing the world to perhaps a more Buddhist one, is to move away from this kind of heroic doing it all oneself towards just seeing oneself as part of something. I've spoken about this before, but one of the great sort of lessons, one of the great learnings for me when I was doing things with Joanna Macy was something she said about it's all right. You know, we look inside ourselves, we look at the world, we sort of see the sort of scale of problems in the world. We look inside of ourselves and we see that I don't have the resources to bring about that sort of change. Well, actually, that's all right, because I don't have to do it. It's not I, it's we. And that for me came as such a sort of relief, that actually I don't have to change the world. Oh, thank goodness, because actually I've got no chance of doing it. What I can do is sort of align myself with those people around me who have that intention, who have that crazy intention that all shall be well with the world. And actually that something between us, a force arises between us that none of us have individually. Anyway, I think that's the truth of Sangha. That is the truth of spiritual community, the sort of magic of spiritual community, of coming together with people with the same ideals, with that same sort of commitment to loving kindness and clarity, to sort of Buddha qualities, and so on. As a Sangha, as a community, we can sort of influence a culture. We can sort of change the ideas of a culture in a way which we can't as individuals. So in a way, well, what we need to do, you know, if we have this mad intention to be a force for good in the world, the first thing we need to do is to look around and see who is there with us. And that was true even for the Buddha. You know, for the Buddha after his enlightenment, after he'd sort of conquered all that horrible sort of ego stuff within himself, all the greed, hatred and delusion, the first thing that the Buddha did was to look around for companions, was to look around for people with whom he could share his insight, with whom he could sort of share the task, as it were, of communicating this for the welfare of the world. And if it's true for the Buddha, well, it's even more true for us. So, well, confidence in the Sangha, I just think, is completely sort of vital. That is, the Sangha is the way in which we're a force for the good in the world. I'll just finish with one last sort of reflection, and it comes from, again, looking through the Dhammapada. I was looking through the Dhammapada to see the Dhammapada is a sort of collection of sayings of the Buddha, and I was looking for things that, well, what did the Buddha say about being a force for good in the world? And it crops up a couple of times. The way the Buddha describes it is a bit like, well, someone who's sort of committed to the spiritual life. It's as if when somebody does that, it's a bit like the moon emerging from clouds in the world. Okay, it's a very sort of beautiful image. But as Buddhist practitioners, you know, the more that we sort of address our own states of mind, that we bring into the world Buddha qualities, that it's like light coming into the world, it's like sort of the moon emerging from behind dark clouds. So it's almost like what we need to do is just sort of get out of the way. It's not like that we have to sort of shine from our own resources. This idea of being a force for good in the world is something much more sort of subtle, much more sort of beautiful. And it's something that we do by, in a way, sort of getting out of the way. And we can have the sort of confidence that when we do that, something shines through into the world. Yeah, very, very sort of gentle. And that is the sort of nature. I think the Buddhist idea of a force for good in the world, it isn't necessarily through the way we might think of it. It's not a sort of forceful force for good in the world. It's something, in a way, quite ephemeral, quite difficult to sort of touch, to sort of prove. But I think it's something that, in a way, that we can develop a sort of confidence through having a confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. And I'll finish there. If there's any questions or points, then I'd be very happy to take them.